This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This has been an historic Democratic convention, the first time an African American has won a major party nomination, and the first time a woman has come so close to getting it. A little later, we'll reflect on the significance of Barack Obama's nomination. But first, we're going to consider the significance of Hillary Clinton's campaign, the speeches she and Bill Clinton gave this week, and the place of the Clintons now in the Democratic Party. Our first guest is Joshua Green, a senior writer at The Atlantic magazine. He wrote an article in the September edition about problems within Hillary Clinton's campaign. The article included leaked emails and memos revealing conflicts within the campaign and strategies campaign leaders used and considered using against Obama. Green is at the Democratic convention. Joshua Green, welcome to Fresh Air. What was your take on Bill Clinton's speech last night?
Well, I thought it was terrific, especially given the intensity of the recent inter-party squabbling. Clinton really reminded everybody why he is such an astonishing political figure. He was known during his time in the White House as the comeback kid. I think the name applies after last night again. He did just about everything I think he could have done on Barack Obama's behalf. And in doing so, I think he went a long way toward restoring a damaged reputation.
And what about Hillary's speech?
I think Hillary did what was required of her. I don't think she went nearly as far as Bill Clinton did. Her speech, while gracious and while sort of ticking through the things that she needed to get through, it didn't have the passion. It didn't offer the specific personal endorsement that her husband's offered. When Bill Clinton got up there, he said, "You know, I know this man, and he is ready to be president." Clinton never quite went that far. She said, "No way, no how, no McCain." She drew some important contrasts. But one got the sense that she was holding back a little bit, even so.
The convention started with this drama of what's going to happen between the Hillary people and the Obama campaign, and will they make up, and will she really throw her support behind him? And then I think there was such enthusiasm for Bill Clinton's speech, and I think a lot of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton's speech. Do you think, in a way, it's almost been like makeup sex within the party? That there's this, you know what I mean? That there's this like feeling of exhilaration that
yes,
a lot of people weren't counting on.
That's the best analogy I've heard, and frankly, not one that would quite have sprung to mind. But yeah, I suppose that's about what I'd call it. There were so many worries and expectations on both parties. You know, just 2 weeks ago, there was squabbling in the newspaper with some of Bill Clinton's folks. Leaking that, you know, he was unhappy with the assignment of having to talk about national security. He'd rather talk about the economy so he could kind of summon his own record. And in the event, he wound up talking about both of them and really sort of transcending the whole thing. I mean, his speech was the single best endorsement of a Barack Obama presidency that I've heard from anyone, and one that I think will be hard to top. So I would say that certainly the Obama wing of the party has to be exultant after last night. And when you stop and think about all the Clinton-Obama drama that has sort of played out, even since South Carolina, they really couldn't have done more on Obama's behalf at this convention, I think, than they did. So I think after last night, this kind of closes the book on the Clintons for now, provided we don't have any more of these flare-ups.
Do you have any idea of what happened behind the scenes, what kind of negotiations between the Hillary Clinton people and the Obama people about what she'd say, what she maybe wanted in return for making an enthusiastic endorsement, likewise with Bill Clinton?
Well, I think what Hillary Clinton wanted was to maintain some leverage, to maintain some hold over these 18 million voters whose vote she won in the primary. And I think that's something that rubbed the Obama folks the wrong way. Tradition in politics holds that if you lose, you rally around your party's candidate, and both Clintons seemed less than fully willing to do that. In the negotiations going on behind the scenes, the Obama folks, I think, were very bothered by the fact that Clinton tried to argue and kind of maintain this leverage. Because they believe, and I think most people believe, that if she gets a chance, she's going to run for president again. And Clinton didn't want to yield the supporters that she felt she'd earned. So that was a real source of tension. Beyond that, I think that there were some sort of growing pains. The Clintons and their supporters, their fundraisers, have been the stars in the center of the Democratic universe for 16 years. that's no longer the case. And I think that there's a difficult period of adjustment going on for a lot of them.
We know a lot of people within the Democratic Party perceive Hillary Clinton as having dragged out her concession long after it was clear that she'd lost, and keeping the party divided for a long period of time when it needed to be unifying. And yet now, I think the Clintons are perceived as having given real strong speeches endorsing Obama. So can you talk about where the Clintons stand now in the party, where Hillary stands in the Senate? Do you think that now that the Clinton speeches are done, does she have more or less power in the party and in the Senate than she did before?
I think because of the fact that they both acquitted themselves gracefully, that they both do still have significant power in the party. She, because she still has a slot in the Senate, and he, because he really went a long, long way, I think, toward redeeming a tarnished legacy. Had Bill Clinton not delivered that speech and Obama lost in the fall, I think his behavior over the course of the last 6 to 8 months would have been a real stain on his record. I think his speech was so strong last night that even in the event that Obama does not win in November, I think Clinton has largely redeemed himself. You can't watch that speech and think to yourself, Bill Clinton didn't go all out on Obama's behalf. As to the question of where they go from here and what sort of power they hold, I think a lot of that depends on what happens in November. If Obama wins, I think Bill Clinton will assume the role of kind of elder party wise man that I think he'd like. I wouldn't be surprised to see him shuttling back and forth between Washington and the Middle East. The question of Hillary Clinton is a much more difficult one. On the one hand, she's earned these millions and millions of supporters. On the other hand, it's not exactly clear what she can do with that power. If Obama's elected, she probably won't be able to run for president again for 8 years. I don't think she's popular enough within the Democratic Party to make a serious bid for majority leader. And so that leaves the sort of question of what does she do? The one option I can see that would seem to make sense and play to her strengths is really to take a lead role in the Senate on something like universal health care. Ted Kennedy, who made a dramatic appearance at the convention, is obviously ailing. While he's vowed to be on the Senate floor when Congress opens next January, it's going to be such an epic struggle to pass legislation of this scope. It's going to take more than Kennedy. It's going to take someone of Hillary Clinton's energy and expertise on the issue. So I think that's one way, at least in the short term, that she can still have an important public role and put some of this power and some of this excitement that still surrounds her candidacy to use in the U.S. Senate.
Have you heard talk behind the scenes about the possibility of Obama, if he wins, offering Hillary Clinton a position in the cabinet or considering her as a Supreme Court justice?
The talk of that mainly was during that period when the Obama folks were trying to sort of shuffle Hillary off the stage as quickly and as gracefully as they could. I haven't heard a lot of talk to that effect since then. For one thing, I'm not sure that Obama wants Clinton in his administration just because of the distractions that it might pose. Now, the Supreme Court would avoid a little bit of that and would certainly be an honor for Clinton. So I suppose that's one possibility. But beyond that, I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton wants a position in an Obama administration, even a fairly senior one. I mean, when you think about it, she has basically already served 8 years as co-president, vice president. So, making her Secretary of Transportation or Secretary of State or something to those effects is really, I think, a bit of a step down for her. And I'm not sure it's one that would hold a great deal of appeal.
You wrote an article in The Atlantic magazine that got a lot of attention about emails in the Hillary campaign that were leaked to you that showed some of the tactics the campaign was developing or considering developing against Barack Obama. These emails also showed divisions and anger within Hillary Clinton's campaign. Do you know what impact that had on the Clinton campaign or on the Obama campaign and on the Clinton-Obama relationship?
I've sort of gotten a back channel earful from both campaigns. I think that it helped to underscore the divisions between the two camps. It reminded both of them that there were a lot of bad feelings. A lot of the material that I got was from Mark Penn, her chief strategist, who wanted to run a very aggressive and negative campaign against Obama. And if you talk to people in the Obama universe, from senior strategists down to fundraisers, one of the reasons that they are so angry at Clinton is because of Penn, her chief strategist, and their belief that he was really out to damage Obama, not just to win the Democratic nomination. So I think the emails and memos made this coming together a little bit more difficult. But having said that, the speeches that the Clintons gave at the Democratic Convention, I think, really put all this stuff in the rearview mirror.
Which email do you think the Obama campaign found most disturbing?
I think a March strategy memo from Mark Penn, in which he laid out the case against Obama and talked specifically of wanting to go over what Penn called his lack of American roots. But even more broadly, I think it was the intensity with which the Clinton campaign kept pursuing and attacking Obama late into the spring and long after it was mathematically all but certain that Obama was going to be the nominee. I think seeing some of these behind-the-scenes strategy memos and what they were doing and saying at the time was something that kind of, you know, might have opened old wounds a little bit and reminded the Obama and Clinton folks why they dislike each other.
I should point out that Hillary Clinton decided not to follow the Mark Penn strategy.
You know, at the risk of sort of getting into the, I'm not entirely convinced that she didn't follow the Mark Penn strategy. Penn's strategy didn't say go out and call him a Muslim in a turban. It said we need to do this very quietly and behind the scenes, and we need to surround you with American flags and talk about how you're American from the middle of America. And she did an awful lot of that, as has McCain.
He was saying to her, you have to own the word American.
Yeah.
Tell us something you've seen behind the scenes at the convention that we won't have seen on television that you think is revealing about what's happening at the Democratic convention.
The number of people with Hillary supporters for Obama buttons. There's a tendency with you know, there are 15 million reporters in town, and everybody needs to file stories, and you know, cable news needs to air a lot of footage. And so the sense I get in my hotel room watching TV is that there's this large community of angry Clinton supporters who are not going to vote for Barack Obama, who are going to support John McCain and upset the election. And the truth is, if you go out and wander around the floor and talk to delegates, you'd be hard-pressed to find one of them. I must have spoken to dozens, if not hundreds, of them over the last 3 days, and I've only found one or two people that are really bitter and are going to refuse to vote for Barack Obama. So I think one of the stories that's been far overplayed is this idea of a lingering division between hardcore Hillary supporters who are unwilling to vote for Barack Obama.
Joshua Green, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's good to be with you.
Joshua Green is a senior writer for The Atlantic. He joined us from Denver. My guest, Katha Pollitt, is at the Democratic Convention. She's a columnist for The Nation and has written extensively about women's issues over the years. We were interested in hearing her take on Hillary Clinton's campaign and her speech endorsing Obama. Katha Pollitt, welcome back to Fresh Air. What's your take on the historic significance of Hillary Clinton's campaign and how her campaign has changed the perception of women in politics or women's issues?
Well, Hillary Clinton wasn't the first woman to run for president. In modern times, that would be Shirley Chisholm, who was also honored here at the convention at one point. But it was the first campaign that actually had a realistic chance of success. She got a phenomenal number, more than 18 million votes, those cracks in the glass ceiling that her supporters talk about. And I think it really had a very important effect, a complicated effect, that somehow even her defeat made women's winning more of a possibility.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think she ran a very big, credible campaign. She became a stronger campaigner as she went on. She learned to laugh at things that hurt her in the beginning, like all that, you know, all that fashion criticism that was so ridiculous. She had to put up with so much sexist nonsense. And I was an Obama supporter, but I really felt for her, you know, that and she learned to be able to roll with that and laugh at that and became a more relaxed and confident campaigner who could really connect with people. And I think that, she ended the campaign as a more showing that a woman could be a very, very viable candidate.
What were your thoughts on Hillary's speech? What was your reaction?
I thought it was phenomenal. I thought it was one of the best speeches I ever heard. And you know what? She looked happy giving it. She was so relaxed and confident. She could make a little fun of herself, you know, the sisterhood of the traveling pantsuit, as she described herself and her staff. And in the video before, which Chelsea introduced, there was actually a little segment where she made gentle fun of, you know, her laugh. And she showed a little segment from that Saturday Night Live skit about her laugh. And, you know, you remember the so-called Hillary cackle was one of the main misogynistic memes of the primary. So I just thought it was a wonderful, wonderful speech. And it just showed she was able to be a big person when it counted.
One of the things Hillary said in her speech that I thought was kind of directly aimed to the people who are saying, I'm voting for Hillary or no one or McCain. She said, I want you to ask yourselves, I'm paraphrasing here, I want you to ask yourselves, were you in this campaign just for me or were you in it for all the people in the country who feel invisible?
That's exactly right. And that's the question. Were you in this campaign just for me? I mean, somehow a symbol can become too important. Do you know that you forget what the symbol symbolizes and what a woman president would be a great thing in and of itself. But it was this is just my opinion. It's mostly a symbol because Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton will both do very, very good things for women's rights. I think Barack Obama really understands the need of appealing to women and of also responding to the crises in women's lives around employment, around reproductive rights, around housing and child support and child care and you name it. And he's got a lot of very, very excellent women on board his campaign and working very hard for him. So, you know, at a certain point, clinging to the Hillary for president theme really is forgetting what the presidency was supposed to do for women.
You supported Barack Obama, but you were appalled at what you've described as the misogynist, vitriol, and mean girl snark aimed at Hillary Clinton. And you're talking about what was directed at her largely from the media. You don't mean from the Obama campaign. What are some of the things that stand out in your mind as being representative of the kind of misogynist remark that today is still aimed at a powerful woman candidate like Hillary?
Well, there were numerous jokes from, I believe, Tucker Carlson and Chris Matthews about the Hillary nutcracker that you could buy for $19.95 that would crush nuts in its steely thighs. They thought that was really hilarious. There was, remember all that fuss over her misty moment in New Hampshire when the fact that she had a misty moment was supposed to mean that she shouldn't be the president. I called Pat Schroeder, you know, who you remember cried when she ended her brief primary run years ago. She told me that she had a whole file of men in politics crying. You know, when a man in politics, including the president, when a man in politics cries, then it's, oh, something so important has happened that this manly man is shedding a few tears. He's having a, you know, but when a woman does it, it's, oh, she's too emotional. She's weak. She's a girl. So, you know, it just went on and on and on. And a lot of it was on MSNBC and CNN, the cable shows. And I think the obsession with her clothes played against her being a seriousness. You remember the notorious article in the Washington Post by their fashion columnist Robin Given about, you know, the supposed cleavage that Hillary displayed on the floor of the Senate, you know, by wearing a shell that is so much more modest than what I'm wearing now, let me tell you. But somehow this was supposed to be, oh, my God, you know, is she a woman? Is she a politician? I can't decide. It was ridiculous, just ridiculous. The media really needs to get over its discomfort with women as anything but, you know, babes or grandmas.
Katha Pollitt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry.
Katha Pollitt spoke to us from Denver. She's a columnist for The Nation. Her memoir, Learning to Drive, will be published next month in paperback. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, on the 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, Barack Obama will accept his party's nomination for president, making him the first African-American to receive a major party's nomination for that position. It's difficult for many Americans to talk about how race figures into politics, but it's not hard for my guest, Mark Sawyer. He directs the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics at UCLA, where he's also an associate professor of African American Studies and Political Science. Mark Sawyer, welcome to Fresh Air. What significance do you think it has in American history to have an African American as the nominee of a major party?
It's a huge significance. It means that the way we think about ourselves as Americans may be changing dramatically. African Americans have been on the outside looking in sometimes this American story, or in some ways a kind of pariah, or, I mean, to use Du Bois' term, double consciousness, sort of in the outside looking in, or vice versa. So therefore, it means that African Americans may, or we may begin to think of ourselves much more as a part of the American story, a central part, than we've been given credit for in the past.
Can I ask what the personal significance is to you that an African American is accepting his party's nomination for president?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the night that it was clear that he was going to be the nominee, I was doing an interview with a radio show in London. I think I was almost in tears, and I said, I've never felt so American as today, as if America might have embraced me. And that's difficult because oftentimes a lot of African Americans have struggled with their patriotism because of the legacy of slavery and racism. Particularly, even as a political scientist, I'm aware that flag waving has sometimes been associated with negative feelings about the other, including African Americans, immigrants, and others. And that's a discernible thing that we can find in actual data.
What kind of data are you referring to?
Well, in public opinion data, in particular, whites who express high levels of patriotism frequently express high levels of anti-black racism. You wouldn't think that the things are necessarily automatically associated with one another, but there is. That is, their love of America has been constructed under the idea, and frequently either a conscious or subconscious idea, that America is a white nation and needs to stay that way. And so they tend to express a kind of distaste for the other the more that they love America. And there's a huge literature on this that basically shows this time and time again.
Now, you mentioned patriotism. Michelle Obama has been accused of being unpatriotic of comments that you made about America. So how do you interpret the use of that word in the context of the campaign?
Yeah, I think there's a debate between two kinds of patriotism. One is a kind of patriotism saying, I love America, right or wrong, no matter what it does. And even the sort of Rush Limbaugh characters, who are always sort of critical of America, right? America's on the wrong track, still claim that kind of patriotism. Another is a kind of critical patriotism, which is the project that is America is a work in progress, and we are struggling to live up to our best values as embodied by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and people like Martin Luther King and Benjamin Franklin and Frederick Douglass or Susan B. Anthony, and that a kind of patriotism that says, I love my country enough to struggle to help it to become what it might be, that sort of beacon on a hill. And I think that kind of patriotism has frequently been criticized and attacked, and was the kind that Michelle was expressing when she said, this is a time I feel very proud of our country, the first time I feel very proud of our country. She was saying that the sort of upwelling of support, the love for someone by so many people, of someone who's different than them, made her feel very proud, in which she frequently had seen the opposite of that.
Barack Obama represents a younger generation of American leaders and of African American leaders. He will be accepting his party's nomination on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Would you reflect a little bit about differences in the issues for those two generations of leaders?
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be more profound. I mean, on one hand, there's one set of issues that have largely been sort of taken off the table, which was the sort of one central aim of what Martin Luther King cited as the freedom struggle was civil rights. Civil rights were accomplished with the 64, 65 acts that provided for public accommodations, voting rights, et cetera. Now the struggle is about what part will African Americans and largely people of color more generally play in the American story? What will be the terms of their inclusion moving forward into the 21st century? There's been a very complicated response. Incarceration is up. Poverty still remains a problem. The question is on what terms will we be a part of this American story? How much can we, to what degree will we be able to embrace it? What will be our central role? And will we have a more interdependent and connected future across racial lines? And in fact, right now, the current thing is that my argument is that if African-Americans and Latinos, America is dependent upon them. The future of America depends upon, as by, you know, 2042, the census says that there will be no majority group. Minorities will be such a large part of the American landscape.
You know, during the Democratic primary, Hillary Clinton ran a historic candidacy, you know, as a woman who was getting so close to getting her party's nomination. And she made being a woman a focal point of that campaign. Now, Barack Obama was also in a historic situation on the verge of getting his party's nomination. But he didn't make being African-American a focal point of his campaign in the way that Hillary made being a woman a focal point of hers. Do you think that there would have been a difference focusing on his race for him as, you know, compared to Hillary focusing on her gender?
Well, it would have been a disaster for him to have run explicitly as a black candidate, talking about race issues frequently. That tends to scare voters. In fact, political scientists have a term that we call deracialized campaigns, in which black candidates seek to pursue campaign strategies where they don't emphasize race or racial difference. Think about the contrast of someone like a Sharp James or a Coleman Young in Detroit who talked about racial empowerment. But for the most part, black candidates who need to get white votes for a long time have not wanted to racialize their campaigns. They've tried to use universal appeals generally and have to. The question is whether the campaign gets racialized for them. But especially given the gender breakdown of the Democratic primary, it was a plus for Hillary Clinton to particularly use the gender issue as a way of getting support and emphasizing the historic nature of her candidacy and particularly pulling in the kind of second wave feminist ethos into her campaign.
There have been times when Barack Obama has been accused of playing the race card. You have a great definition, by the way, I should ask you for about the race card.
Yeah. So the race card comes from O.J.'s lawyer, Robert Shapiro, when he said about the O.J. trial that we played the race card and we played it from the bottom of the deck. And I guess from what that meant is that it's a sort of get out of jail free card. It's that when an African-American is facing some criticism, if there is such a thing as a race card, they're supposed to be believed that they can sort of claim that the critique is or the criticism is somehow racist, and therefore it disappears. It sort of stops whites in their tracks. It's sort of a version of garlic and a cross to a vampire or something. And it's generally perceived to be used as a kind of tactic to blunt what would otherwise be fair criticism. The problem is no such thing exists, especially in the context of a political campaign. Any week when Barack Obama is talking about race or racism, is a week in which he's losing because talking about that issue cues for whites his racial difference. And you can see that reflected in the polls. One of the campaign tactics that his campaign has sometimes fallen into but been baited into is to get them talking about race. And it's tough because they have to in some ways inoculate themselves from very sort of subtle uses of race that play on unconscious fears and prejudices and make them conscious for voters, but at the same time not turn the dialogue to being about race in a way that will turn off white voters and make him sort of the black candidate and not able to have a universal appeal.
Now, you said that you like a candidate like Barack Obama can't play the race card because to talk directly about race will be a losing battle, like an African-American candidate who needs a white vote to can't win that way. Now, what about, say, Clarence Thomas? Now, I know he wasn't running for a popular vote, but when he was going through his confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justice, some of his critics said that he emphasized his autobiography and the racial aspects of his autobiography to inoculate himself against criticism because his critics risked sounding like racists.
Right. And he also, well, he even used the comment that he was the victim of a high-tech lynching.
Exactly.
And he played race against gender, which was the line of attack, which was that he had engaged in a certain kind of he had sexually harassed Anita Hill, literally. And so what Clarence Thomas was doing, and when an African-American strikes that, but in the context of a conservative conversation, which is to say, I'm black and I don't buy into those things that other black people do. So racism has not ruled my life. Racism has been this thing that I've consistently overcome and been able to move aside. And in fact, Barack Obama frequently, in the way that he talks about race, tries to talk about race in a way of overcoming, transcending, or weaving the struggle for racial equality into the fabric of the American narrative, in such a way that Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass and abolitionists become sort of founding fathers alongside the Jeffersons, the Franklins, and the Washingtons, in a sort of sense of perfecting a more inclusive America. So there's two very different uses. It's not as if he doesn't use race at all, but it's that talking specifically or hurling accusations about sort of white racism or calling the candidate or your opponent a racist plays very poorly.
Let me quote something for you. This was an op-ed in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution by Cynthia Tucker. And she wrote about how the Obama's narratives have brought new kinds of personal narratives into national politics. She wrote, "Win or lose, Obama's campaign has already changed the nation's racial dynamic, if only by highlighting the accomplishments of the black middle class." I wonder if you agree with her on that.
Yes, but I mean, we also had the Cosby Show that kind of highlighted the accomplishments of the black middle class, which was, you know, probably one of the number one shows in the 80s. And I think it kind of continues that narrative. One thing I will say that I think
of course that was a TV show.
Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't entirely real, so people could dismiss it. But there was some evidence that, in particular, whites did really think it was real, and sort of wondered why there were so many black poor people when the Cosbys were doing so well. But on Michelle's speech Monday, I thought the one thing that was really startling was an African American love story that we don't see frequently in Hollywood. The way she talked about their courtship, their family, the way they fell in love with one another. We don't often see that in Hollywood or elsewhere. There very rarely are black actors even paired together to tell a story of a romantic character. And so her speech was striking in that Barack Obama was playing a romantic lead, in a sense, and then sort of transfers into kind of father's knows best, you know, a stable father, family man. But the beginning of the story was about him, you know, playing the sort of guy trying to get the girl that we don't often see in sort of in African-Americans in Hollywood and elsewhere on television.
Tell me what else you heard in Michelle Obama's speech on Monday that you're not used to hearing as part of the political discourse.
I guess her willingness to really have to explain her background, not just tell a story or tell how wonderful, but that she had to try and gin up a sense to make people understand where she comes from by being very vivid in the description. But she also had to simultaneously really, it was an extraordinary tightrope act, avoid any sense of black anger. So particularly when she talked about her father and his working through MS and being a city worker, that there were just a set of expectations that she had that she would do well and that her and her brother would struggle and work hard to get ahead. But that she didn't really talk about any sense of kind of impediment or struggle. So it was just an interesting tightrope act. And just some of the things, there's some evidence that the sort of very her height, her physicality is she's a very striking woman, both in the way she stands. It's going to be interesting to see how that the speech that appeared on Monday plays in the context of the broader convention, because it was designed to appeal to the emotion of Democrats and to create an emotional connection and empathy with the Obama family, including bringing out the daughters in the very unscripted moment. But there may be an empathy gap.
You said that you thought that Michelle Obama consciously tried to avoid expressing anything that would sound like black anger. She has been accused by people on the right of being angry. Why is, you use a phrase like black anger. What does that phrase mean to you? What are the implications of it?
Well, the implications of it is an African-American who sees racism as something that has dominated their lives, largely by, this is probably largely in the white imagination, and wants to exact some kind of revenge. Nat Turner, for instance, for having experienced that, or even the kind of comments about the LJ jury, that they were somehow taking revenge on whites for all of the sort of injustices that they've experienced. And writing about this goes all the way back. I mean, Thomas Jefferson suggested that blacks might not be fit to be citizens because of the rage of having experienced slavery. And it's one of those things that cues concern and mistrust amongst whites. And she specifically tried to avoid it. She talked about working hard. She talked about overcoming poverty and her father's kinds of illnesses. But she didn't really talk about any experiences of race or racism growing up. And so it was a kind of tightrope act to talk about, to present struggle and not being spoon-fed without portraying it in an angry way.
You were talking about how whites perceive quote, black anger as being threatening, as being like resentful, as maybe being about people who are looking for revenge against white people for injustices against black. Do you think that makes it difficult for Barack Obama to wage a very aggressive campaign in fighting back against attack ads and other attacks against him from Republicans, out of fear that it might be perceived as the kind of, quote, black anger that you were talking about?
I think it means that he cannot use the powerful emotions of fear and anger in his campaign because it might cue, or as well as indignation, because they might cue that kind of response or that kind of concern. He has to portray himself as kind of above that. Otherwise, he might become angry black man. And I think those who have sort of suggested that Obama go more aggressively on the attack don't always appreciate his concern for if he were to go on the attack in a very strident fashion, that he might cross over, that he would all of a sudden become and begin to look like Al Sharpton, no matter what he was saying.
You said that you thought maybe there would be an empathy gap in their response to Michelle Obama's speech. What do you mean by that? What are you thinking of?
Well, frequently both in sort of social science issues, but also in other kinds of things, there's a kind of white resentment of black success or struggle. So they don't feel a sort of sense of empathy with the struggle. They don't see themselves in the struggle. And in fact, there's the opposite reaction, which is there's resentment. And just for the sense of kind of fairness, right, that speech would play as if a white person were giving it and would invoke a sort of empathetic reaction. One may politically disagree with Michelle and Barack Obama. But if there's an empathy gap, it'll mean that that speech, which talked about her struggle and their successes and their ability to become a kind of successful family and Barack Obama's rise as well as hers, might spur a kind of resentment among some whites.
Because?
Well, because it's perceived as being undeserved. They don't see themselves in that struggle. They don't see, and they see black success as being a result of affirmative action, government programs, handouts, special treatment, those kinds of things.
I thought it was interesting the way she talked about her mother saying to her, when she went to college, you know, when Michelle went to college, that more college-educated children need to return home to the community, and that both, you know, Michelle and Barack Obama ended up doing that after leaving home to go to Ivy League schools.
Yeah, the quote from her mother was echoing a sense of service and racial uplift, but one that's perfectly consistent with some of the arguments of W.E.B. Du Bois and even Booker T. Washington, for that matter, and a long history of African-American tradition, but one that's ultimately non-threatening, right, which is the idea that you want to uplift, you want to encourage, you want to help build the African-American community as part of the entire American community.
So, you know, Barack Obama is not only the first African-American candidate to win his party's nomination, he's the first biracial candidate to win his party's nomination. And I wonder how you see the biracial aspect of his background as uniting and or dividing America in how it's being discussed. And how he's discussing it, how he's being attacked by opponents, and so on.
I think he actually uses it quite well in that he has a way of layering his identities that is very authentic, right? He doesn't seem to be he simultaneously thinks of himself as wholly African American, but also biracial, very much identifies with his mother's family. The way people write about it sometimes can be quite shocking. I remember a piece in the Atlantic Monthly that talked about his mother taught him too well to express black rage, as if, you know, somehow, you know, that's there's no black mother that could ever teach him that, or, you know, to be well spoken and polite and those kinds of things. So it's a very strange way, but it also shows how much in operation the one drop rule is. I also wonder a little bit if the campaign might be different if his mother were still alive and with us.
What do you think about when you think of that?
Well, the idea that he would have her as a kind of articulate advocate to present his story and who he is. In particular to the large sort of the basic base of swing voters, which is older white women. In as much as you think about Michelle trying to be the Michelle Obama, trying to be the surrogate, thinking about his mother being the surrogate to those group of people, the woman who raised him, who would be a sort of white woman from that particular generation.
So any further thoughts before we have to wrap up about the historic significance of Barack Obama accepting his party's nomination and accepting it on the night of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech?
Well, where simultaneously he represents the first generation that grew up without Jim Crow. But at the same time, my great-grandfather was a slave. And it really marks both the sort of incredible set of progress that's been made in the context of the American story, but also speaks to the, in some ways, the strangeness of the moment. I think the war in Iraq, the flagging economy, created an opening and change. These kinds of changes, at least in my research, don't happen slowly over time, but happen in huge convulsive shifts. And we may be on the brink of one.
Mark Sawyer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
Mark Sawyer directs the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics at UCLA, where he's also an associate professor of African American Studies and Political Science. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.